So welcome all to this week's Q&A session. Guests, as always, are welcome. If you want to join, I'll put the link into the chat. If anybody wants to join, but by all means, we do welcome guests, and you're free to do so, even if you're not a member. Let me just paste this in. Okay. So I am muting everybody now, and you will have the ability to unmute yourself. Please feel free to do so if you have a question or comment. Please remute yourself afterwards so it keeps background noise to a minimum. Later on this evening, a PDF of the deck that gets presented, the audio recording, and the contents of the chat window will go up on our website. And with that, I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Okay, so we have a new option tonight. We've decided that we're going to try to reserve the last 10 minutes for your questions. And so we're giving you a heads up. Think about the questions that you want to ask. The best way to do it is to jot them down in the chat window, and Chris will be monitoring that towards the end of the session, and then we'll bring up all the questions that have been added in there. Anyway, so last 10 minutes, hopefully we'll have like an open microphone or open chat window, and we'll have ad hoc questions. So think about what you'd like to ask. Okay, the first thing I have on the prepared agenda is a follow-up to the, what was it, the cookie blocker option that I mentioned last week. And I said that when I loaded this, the Guardian newspaper, I got this subscription window popping up. And when I loaded the cookie blocker, I still got the subscription notice, so it didn't do anything to that subscription notice. Turns out that's not correct. When I check back, and I actually load the cookie blocker up here, when I load the Guardian, you can see that it does block that subscription notice. So, and it blocks all kinds of things. Okay, so moving along, Chris has a share on mailing lists.
Yeah, this is dealing with a frustration that I came across not too long ago, I guess. When you're on a mailing list, and the PC User Group member forum is an example of such a mailing list, when you get an email come in from that, the idea behind mailing lists is that if you do a reply, it goes back to the list, and that way everybody sees the response rather than just the person who initiated whatever it is you're replying to. So this is normally configured through a header line in the email, and so I have an example there of a message that was sent out to opcug-member-forum@ GoogleGroups.com address. And so in the headers, which you normally don't see, there is a reply to line. And this instructs your mail program that when you do a reply, this is where the reply is supposed to go to, not to, as you see in there, X original sender, alan.germ@opcug.ca. Next. So most email clients actually do follow the rules properly. So here's an example of Gmail. And this is just on the web, and this is a message that came in to the forum. Next. And you can see that if you hit the reply actually goes back to the forum as opposed to going back to alan.german@opcug.ca, who's the originator of the message. So they're following the rules correctly. Next. Thunderbird, not so much. So with Thunderbird, here's again a message from Alan that he posted to the member forum, and you can see it's from Alan posted to the forum. And if I click on reply, it actually goes to alan.germ@opcug.ca as opposed to the list. Now they do have in Thunderbird, next, reply list is an option, and in that case it would actually, the reply would go back to the list as opposed to going to Alan. But that's not following the rules. Okay, the rules really are, you know, the reply header says replies are supposed to go back to the list. So while you can work around it, Thunderbird is not following the rules. Next. You can actually fix it so that they follow the rules. And you can see through this how they admit right up front that they're not following the rules. If you go to Tools Settings General and Config Editor, you get a huge long page of things that can be configured within Thunderbird. And click on the Show All button, and then you scroll down to mail.override_list_reply_2. So they, and the default is true. So they really admit up front in the way that this setting is that they're not following the rules. They are overriding the reply to on mailing lists. So next. So if you double click on it, or you click the toggle button on the right, you can change it to false. And after that, Thunderbird will act properly in that it will obey any reply to headers that it sees. So if you are using Thunderbird and you are annoyed by the fact that replies to list messages go back to the sender, here's how you can fix it so that they follow the mail rules correctly. I don't know of any other mail client that doesn't follow the rules correctly, but if you do have one, you might want to dig deep into the configuration of it and see if you can correct it. That's it.
Thanks, Chris. That's a really useful tip. I actually do use Thunderbird, and that's been a problem for me for a while. I often just hit reply, and I wonder why it doesn't show up in the email list on Gmail later on. It's because it hasn't gone to the group. It's gone to the individual. And Bob says, if I forward an interesting forum group post to another person, you might be interested. Could that new person unsubscribe me by accident?
No, because the any unsubscribe messages have to come from the originator's email as opposed to whoever you forwarded it onto.
So he could only unsubscribe himself.
Oh, actually, I just suddenly thought maybe there is, because in the email itself there's an unsubscribe link. Let me just look and see if I can find an example of one. I'll come back to that during other people's presentation. I'll look that up, and I'll let you know if that is actually an issue or not. It may well be. So I'll come back to that.
So Justin,
if you unsubscribe by email, then it won't work. But if you unsubscribe by a link, then it will. So if I forward a message on from a list, I always delete that part where it says manage your subscription of some sort, like unsubscribe.
Yeah, because that'll just take you to a web. It's just a web link, eh? So yeah, I think you're right, but I'll double check that as well. But I think you're right.
Yeah, Bob says he sometimes moves that link too.
Yeah.
Justin has a question. If you set this override to false, how do you reply to the originator?
I don't know if they changed, let me just see if they changed something else here, because if I do read on the message, no, you would have to manually do it, I think, would be the only way to actually do it, because in Thunderbird you still have the reply, but in this case it actually does a reply to the list, and the reply to list also does a reply to list. Let me try one other thing. If I do a reply all, you could do a reply all, which would put the list as well as the originator on the to line, and then you could just remove the list. So that would be a workaround for it. If you only wanted to go back to the sender, do a reply all, and then remove the list address from it.
Or you could dig into the header, because the originator's email will be in the header somewhere.
Yeah, but this is the easiest, and you don't have to hunt for things or anything like that. So yeah, but you could just copy it from there, yeah.
Okay, so Bill Van Dyke says, when I send a message to the OPCUG forum, it's not echoed back to me. I use Outlook. Is it a list issue or is it Outlook?
It must be Outlook. I know that Gmail does that because they don't really have a concept of your sent items being separate from inbox. And so when you reply to it back to the list, it thinks it's the same message. It knows it's the same message, essentially. And so basically it throws it away, anything coming back from the list, because it says, well, I've already got a copy of this in the sent items. I didn't know that Outlook did the same thing. So I think it's an Outlook issue as opposed to a mail client issue per se. There are header things that do identify each list message uniquely. So I guess any email client can look to that and say, I've already seen this, so therefore I don't need to give you another copy of it. I don't know any way around it.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Okay, so next up, Tom Trottier is going to share his screen because he has a share for us on OpenDNS. So take it away, Tom.
Okay, let me share my screen here. Share screen, yes. And this is what I want to share, and share. Hope you can all see that. Use
yes.
OpenDNS to
yep.
filter out bad domains and some ads. So the domain name system basically translates domain names like google.ca to IP addresses like this used by the internet's hardware. So you need a domain name server that actually translates between the domain names and the IP. So your internet provider provides one. And that's the default for your modem or your phone. You can choose one, and the list this utility uses, which is from GibsonResearchCorporation.com, and that will actually benchmark a list of maybe, 100 different DNS servers and tell you which one is the fastest. But they have a list, so you can actually choose. Quad9.net is one in the list above, which provides protection from malware, and that's actually what I use in my computer, but it's not the one I use in my modem. And then there's this other program, other service that provides a DNS called OpenDNS.com. It's another one that you can configure. It's a free service, and I'll show you how it works. Now, how do you install it? In the modem, it looks something like this. And this is down at the bottom. This is where you put it, the DNS server and the secondary DNS server. By the way, I'm using Zoomit for the first time, so that's how I'm able to zoom and do other stuff like that. So this is how it, where you would put it. And it's in network under LAN settings, and this is in my TP-Link modem. So this is how you would specify it down here. Now OpenDNS provides a variety of services. It's not just you put it in and you change it. By the way, these are the actual numbers you need to put in, and it will tell you that on the service. But here is the OpenDNS settings, and you can see there are a variety of things: home, stats, settings, my account, support, tell a friend. But it also provides stats and logs, and you can actually put in a whole bunch of settings. Now, as for the settings, you can block things by category. You can block things ordinarily by things like this: high, moderate, low, and these are basically preset categories, where you can choose what categories you want to block: advertisements, parked domains, web spam, adware, the stuff I block, and I let basically everything else through. These aren't complete. Even if you block adware and advertisements, it doesn't work against, for example, YouTube, but it does do some stuff. But this is the main thing that I use it for, is the second set of settings, because this page goes down below. As long as the category, you can choose to block. You can also block by domain. So you can put in domain names here and then block them. They can be fully qualified or they can be partially qualified. Like this is fully qualified, dadcdigital.com. But you can have three-level domains like metric.gstatic.com. So you can block, put in names. You're limited to 25 in the free service. I think the limit is 50 in the if you pay for the family service. And those are the things that are useful for providing another level of protection against stuff that you don't want to send information to or get information from. Now, one of the things it provides OpenDNS is statistics on stuff that basically stuff that you've looked for, domain names you've looked for, and you can specify about 2 weeks of data or choose a single day and look to see what has been either blocked or accessed. Well, what are you accessing through your DNS? And as you can see, there are samples here of recent activity, unique domains, unique IDs, et cetera, et cetera. But the thing that I use the most, in fact, only, is domains. And you get a list of domains. Now, this is for the last couple of weeks. And as you can see, mewifi.com. Is there up at the top. Mewifi.com is because I have a Wi-Fi router from, I forget now, I think it's Xiaomi. And their router tends to be very noisy and send off a whole bunch of information to China. And I'm not interested in sending information to China. So I've blocked all mewifi.com. In fact, if I go back here, let's see. MeWiFi.com, app.mewifi.com, you guys, you can see they're all blocked. So this is stuff that, by the way, the red marks means it's blocked, black means it's gone through. So Amazon.com gets through, but Device Metrics does not. Google Analytics is blocked. But you can see sort of where your traffic is in here. I got to get the right keys right. So you can see what is being blocked and where your major uses of DNS are, what domains you're accessing and how often. Mtalk.google.com, for example, number 8, is because I have a Google phone and that's from my Android phone, which is connected through this router. And connectivity check and so on. Yes?
Number 11 on your list, Elizabeth says she thinks Baidu.com points to China also.
That's true. I don't discriminate against China per se. I discriminate against stuff that I think is sending off too much information to China. But Baidu.com, I seldom access Baidu, which is, I think, a Chinese search engine. And so it's probably worthwhile for me to block that, too, if it can fit in my list of 25 blocked domains. So this is the, where is it? So this is the stuff that I'm blocking, and as you can see, mewifi.com, so blocked everything above that. But Baidu.com may fit in there. GoogleVideo.com doesn't seem to be working very well to stop stuff, but on my TV, which is connected through my modem on YouTube. So I would suggest that it's a useful tool. You can block a lot of things. And it may not be the service you want for your computer per se, but it certainly is probably worthwhile for Internet of Things and TV and other things that are connected to the Internet. Are there any questions?
Yes, Jocelyn has a question. He says, what do you see if you go to a block domain, and can you bypass the block temporarily?
No, you cannot bypass the block temporarily. And what you see is that it doesn't find the server. You get a message if you're using a browser, then you get a message that the server is not available. You can't find it. I don't have a sample of that.
Okay, there aren't any other questions in the chat. If anybody has a question, you can open your microphone and ask Tom directly.
Just before we move on, I guess I can go back to Bob Harris that asked on the problem with replying to mailing lists, that he had the question about whether if he forwards a message to somebody else, can they unsubscribe him? And for our case, you can't, because the footer of our messages sent out to the mailing list say to unsubscribe, send an email to, and it's the name of the forum plus unsubscribe at googlegroups.com. So if somebody else was to do that, it would be trying to unsubscribe their email address from it, not Bob's email address and that. But that's not necessarily the case with other mailing lists. Other mailing lists could well be tied to the original recipient's email address. And a lot of them will do that. To unsubscribe, click here, and it'll try to unsubscribe the email address that the email was originally sent to. So I would watch it on other mailing lists, and as Tom says, take a look at the footer of messages that you forward on to remove that information before you send it on to somebody else is probably the best thing to do.
Okay, we've answered more questions, Tom, but there's one comment. So Elizabeth says, good information, Tom. So thank you very much. Okay, so moving along, since Tom was talking about modems, Chris and I have some information about security settings. And this basically came about because I switched to Bell and had some issues setting up the modem and trying to go with Chris's recommendations from one of his library presentations. So he's going to give you the kind of his idea of what the security setting should be for Rogers, and then I'll come back and talk about Bell. So Chris, go ahead.
Yep. So what you see on the screen are the top level six items that I think everybody should verify is actually off in your internet router or configured in your internet router. We'll go through each of these. So next. So the first one is setting up the basic security. So I'm recommending setting WPA2 PSK with AES encryption and a unique SSID, a service set identifier, or the name of your network. So on Rogers, if you go to log into the actual gateway, and then you go to connection Wi-Fi, and you hit the edit button, next. You'll find that actually you can't get there from here. So they actually tell you that certain things, such as the security mode, so the WPA PSK with AES encryption, can't be set there. Your network name, the SSID, can't be set there. And the network password can't be set there. And for that, you actually have to download the Rogers Ignite Wi-Fi app onto your smartphone, or you can visit the website, Ignite, wifi.rogers.com. So you don't have to have a smartphone. You can do it through the web, but you can't do it just logged into the gateway itself. Next. And I'll come back to that. So you can change the admin password. So right at the top left-hand corner of the screen, there is a change password or next. You can also go to the troubleshooting section and do a change password. Next. And then it'll ask you for the current password, and then you put in your new password and re-enter the password. Click on the save button, and when you're working on these web page configurations, always look for that save button, because if you don't click on the save button somewhere and you move on to a different page, the setting won't be updated. So make sure you do the save. Next. So the next one is making sure your firewall is on. So in most modern routers now, you'll have an IPv4, so Internet Protocol version 4, which is the four dotted numbers, 0 to 255. Four sets of them, and that's the older style, but it's still there and configured. And so if you go to firewall IPv4, you'll see that you have a number of options available. And if you click on the link on any one of those four, it actually brings up this screen where it gives you a little bit more information about what is involved in each of the settings that you choose. Next. So I think the minimum security low is the default on Rogers, and it actually blocks things that are okay, except that it doesn't block what is known as ICMP or ping, and that's one of the ways that hackers can see if a device exists out on the network at a particular address is they just ping it. Now, there are a lot of other things that will disable ping going along the way anyways, but you want to make sure, if at all possible, that you block ping at your computer as well. Next. If you look at the typical security, I think for most people, this is probably actually the best. There are a bunch of peer-to-peer apps that won't work anymore, but most people don't actually use peer-to-peer apps. If you do, then I hope you know what you're doing and can figure things out for yourself. But for most people, I think if you go to the medium, you will get, in addition to the ident port of 113, you will get ICMP requests or pings will be disabled as well. Next. So the only way that you could possibly end up with the firewall off, and that's the main thing to check for, is that your firewall is on. The only way to get it off is definitely it's not the default, is go to the custom security, and there is a checkbox for disabling the firewall entirely. If you do go into that custom security to do something, don't check that box to say disabling the firewall completely. Next. So the next is the firewall on IPv6. So this is the newer protocol for Internet Protocol, the addressing. And your computer actually will communicate over IPv4 and IPv6 both. So it's good to make sure that the IPv6 firewall is on. Notice that there is typical security defaults and then custom. There's not that different layers of it. And so if you expand in on that, the typical says, WAN to LAN, so that's from the Internet to your computer, block all unrelated traffic and enable IDS, or the intrusion detection system. I hate wording like this. You know, what is unrelated traffic? I don't know. But in actual fact, I think I know what they're getting at, and that is the best security model for most people. If you want, you can go into the custom security, and you can block a couple of extra things that may not get blocked in the typical security, including the ping the ident port. So there are a couple of things that if you know what you're doing, you go into the custom security. But for the average user, I recommend just stick with the typical security. You're probably fine. Next. So again, the only way to disable the firewall entirely is to go under the custom security. So if you do go in there, make sure you don't check that box of disable entire firewall. A firewall in your router is a very good thing. So the next thing is remote administration. You want to make sure that it's turned off. So for that on Rogers, you go to the advanced remote management and you just leave them as disabled. They will be disabled by default. So go in, check them, make sure they are disabled. Next. If you really do need remote management, I highly recommend that if you enable it, you go down and you restrict it as much as you can. So to a single computer would be ideal. So if you know a particular IP address that you want to be able to remotely manage your router from, you could do that, or a range of IPs. So if you're in a business and they have, you know, Class B or Class C address range, so you could put in their entire address range, and that way you could do it from any of the computers that you happen to work at or things like that. But most people, I would think you're better off leaving it disabled. Only enable it if you really, really know what you're doing and you really, really need remote management. Next. Disabling WPS or Wi-Fi protected setup. And so for that, you go into connection, Wi-Fi, and then it's counterintuitive, but you go and click on the add Wi-Fi protected setup client. So click on that, next. Then you can actually go in, you can choose disabled. So if you have no need for Wi-Fi protected setup, I would say turn on the disable, and then you won't be subject to any of the vulnerabilities that are in that particular protocol. Next. I would make sure no matter what you disable WPS pin method, there are only 11,000 possible combinations of WPS pins, and so pretty easy for an attacker to run through 11,000 possible connections and end up connecting to your Wi-Fi. Next. If you really do want it, then go down to where it says the connection options and make sure it's set to push button. The way it works when you have it set to push button is in order to do the connection over WPS, you have to physically go to your Wi-Fi router, press the button, and then for the next 2 minutes, you're able to connect a remote client just using the Wi-Fi protected setup, and then it will turn itself off automatically. So any vulnerabilities in WPS, you're only exposed to it for 2 minutes, and it has to be somebody who is predetermined that they're hanging around outside your house and happen to be there in that 2 minute period. So I think it's pretty safe to have it on if you have push button method. So if you do want to use it, I recommend you use that. Next. So now we're going to go and we're going to look. This is, I'm doing it from the phone. So the website, the ignitewifi.rogers.com, you can go and you can do these changes there as well. I'm going to do it from the screens on the phone. So you install the Ignite Wi-Fi and you click on that. Next. And then once you're there, you'll be asked to sign in. So this is your normal sign in to Rogers on their website. Next. And then you'll get the welcome to, and you click on sign in. And then you can click on view network details. Next. And this is where you can start actually making changes. You click on that pencil icon in the top right-hand corner for edit. And then next. You can put in your network name, and that's the that SSID. And so I just use... for networking devices, I use Galaxies, and for computers and so forth, I use Planets and things like that. And you can put in whatever password you want in there, and you can choose your security mode. Next. So interestingly, I think they did a good job in this in that they only allow it to be either totally open or WPA2. So they don't allow WEP. They don't allow WPA, plain WPA. Which I think is probably a good thing. And so make sure it is set to WPA2 as opposed to being open. You'll notice in the middle screen too, there is two networks that are available on this router. So 2.4 gigahertz and the 5 gigahertz. So if you need to set them on both. So you'll see at the top of that screen, the middle one, it says use a different name for passwords for 2.4 gigahertz and 5 gigahertz. By default, they actually use the same name, and your devices will connect to whatever they think is the best network at any particular point in time. I actually like having mine named differently so I can force devices to use a particular network, either the 2.4 or the 5 gigahertz network, and that's why I name mine Andromeda and Andromeda 5 for the 5 gigahertz. So next. Now I go to Shields Up, which is run by Steve Gibson. And it will actually probe your IP address and see if any ports are open. And interestingly, I did this. Everything was closed except for, or actually stealth, so it didn't even appear on there. But port 445 is shown as being closed rather than stealth. That's not the best because if it responds at all, even to say it's not open, it says there is something there. And so an attacker might decide to, you know, try to find other vulnerabilities, other ways of getting into your particular device and so forth. That's actually new because before, at some point, it didn't show up at all. It was stealth all across the board. I have no idea why they have 445 and it's closed, which means nobody can connect to it. They're not inherently dangerous for a closed port, but it does prevent that stealth. So somebody out there who's trying to attack me could see that there is something there, and they may try more determined attacks on it. I don't think I'm going to bother trying to figure out what's going on and whether I can change that to stealth. I don't know. But it's not, as I say, it's not inherently dangerous. And I think that's it for Roger's Ignite devices.
Okay, thank you, Chris. Bill Van Dyke has a comment. He says, disabling the firewall is useful if you use the router inside your network. So the router is then already protected from the outside, the WAN, but it's open within the protected environment.
That would be true, but I wonder why anybody would have a router that is totally inside the network, because a router's job is to determine whether stuff should stay on the internal network or get sent to a different network. So I'm not sure why anybody would want to have a router inside their own network.
Is it being used as a switch?
Yeah, if you wanted to turn into essentially, yeah, I guess you would be turning it into switch.
Yeah, it can be useful. I mean, I have currently two routers. One is the main one that's connected to the internet directly, and another one that is used to connect other devices. In fact, internally, you may want to have a router that does things that 1 gigabit per second or more, while your router that's connected to the internet may only be at the speed of the internet that you're using. For example, for me, it's only 25 megabits per second.
But you would use a Rogers Ignite router for that?
No. I don't use at all.
Well, that's the thing is I'm only talking about, you know, security settings for a Rogers Ignite Wi-Fi hub. So you sign up with Rogers, you get their Ignite service, and I can't imagine using that device other than to connect to the internet.
Yes, but for other routers inside.
Oh yeah, yeah, sure. I mean, if people know what they're doing and they want to get into some pretty complex internal stuff, but I think that this talk in particular, this is not necessary for anybody who knows enough to be able to start setting up internal routers on their network and so forth. What I'm talking about is second nature to anybody who's in that position. You know, I'm specifically talking about you sign up with Rogers. They give you this device, and it connects you to the internet, and you want to make sure the settings are secure.
Yeah, Bill says he uses a second router in a different area of his property, so he has Wi-Fi available outside the range of the main router.
Yeah, that's right.
The second router is hardwired to the first.
Yeah, yeah, that's not unusual for sure. I mean, yeah, it's essentially you're using it as you've turned it into a switch that is a Wi-Fi switch, I guess, is really what it is, more so than being a real router at that prime point, probably. But at any rate, anybody who knows what they're doing at that point, go for it.
Yeah, Stuart says he's read about using separate internal networks for IoT devices, Internet of Things.
Yeah.
Which would be another kind of switching type thing.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks, Chris. All right, so I just want to remind everybody that about the last 10 minutes, I think, are going to be available for your questions. I haven't seen any questions that haven't related to something we've already been discussing yet. But if you do have a question you want to ask it, you can put it in the chat window, or we'll have an open mic session at the end of this. So moving along, here's my culprit, the Bell HomeHub 3000. And so I'm again trying to do the same kind of thing as Chris did in terms of locking this thing up. So this is the interface when you log on to the admin area. And if you want to change the administration password in this on the Bell system, you have this modem preferences tab, and if you go there, you'll find a modem password administrator box. So you have to enter the current password and then the new password twice to confirm it. And that will essentially reset the administration password for the modem. You want to change the password for the Wi-Fi, then you have a Manage My Wi-Fi tab. And that indeed lets you add a password for the Wi-Fi system that you're using. And at the same time, here is the SSID, which you can enter anything you want. And I highly recommend changing this from Bell 4972 or whatever. I was trying to help a friend install a wireless printer the other day, and there's like a dozen Bell XXXXs, and she didn't know which one was hers. So if you put any name in there that makes any sense at all to you, it really helps identify your network. Okay, the next thing was WPS, this Wi-Fi protected setup. And on the Bell system, it's under Advanced Tools and Settings. And then you get all kinds of different settings here. But here's the WPS box. And when you get onto that, then here's the enable, disable button. And by default, it's set to the button. And Chris said, don't use the pin. And if you remember, when I installed a wireless printer on my system, I mentioned that this software button here was really handy because my router is not in the same place as my wireless printer. So it's not convenient to push the WPS button to do the setup. And setting up a wireless printer for me took a lot longer than 2 minutes. So I was constantly coming back to the screen, hitting this button and giving myself 2 more minutes of ability to change things on the wireless printer. Anyway, if you don't want to use that, you can disable it with the button up here. The next thing was remote access control, and by default, that is disabled. I have no interest whatsoever in allowing anybody to access my modem remotely, so that's left firmly turned off. And in terms of encryption, I couldn't find anything on the Home Hub 3000 that would let me do anything with encryption settings. And Chris found this link, and it basically says that the default security is set to, or the security is set to, I don't even know if you can change it, but it's set to the high level WPA2 PSK. And then the other thing was that whereas Chris can play with firewalls, I can't find anywhere to do anything with firewalls, not even in advanced settings here. There doesn't seem to be anything. And again, Chris gave me some sage advice that they seem to just lock the firewall on, which is fine by me. Again, I'm happy to have a hardware firewall using the router. And if you do want to change that, then you have to essentially configure it for a pass-through and then use a separate router to do whatever you want. So basically, although I couldn't change some of the settings, when you go through the list of WPA2 and unique SSID and so forth, all the boxes are checked and I followed Chris's sage advice. I also tried Shields Up on my system because I like to see it in stealth mode. And I was dismayed to find that one of my ports is not in stealth mode. And so I failed the true stealth analysis task. And when I looked at the port, it turns out in my case on the Bell modem, the port that's closed is port 22, which is SSH remote login. Now again, I got no way of, well, I didn't bother to try and change this. I don't think I can. But at least this port is closed. So although it can be seen by people on the outside, it's closed and they can't actually access it, hopefully. Because it's remote login, I assume that's something that Bell might use to do remote troubleshooting, but I really don't know.
I don't know how they would trigger it to open the port, though. You know, that's I assumed the same thing when I saw that it would be used by Bell, but I don't know how they would force the port to be open. So I don't know.
And you would hope that they can, right?
Yeah, exactly.
They can.
Somebody else can, yeah. Bill has a message here. He says that he has the 3000 as well from Bell, and he says it's important to restrict physical access, even though it allows you to turn off password display on the front, the push button. It resets after a power cycle. I would go so far as to say that the 10 immutable security laws from Microsoft, which date back about 20 years, I think it's law number 2, says if a bad person has physical access to your computer, it's not your computer anymore. And I think that's sage advice, too, that if somebody has physical access to anything, then security bets are pretty much off, no matter what you put in place. And Tom...
Yeah, go on.
Yeah, Tom asks if anybody is using pfSense. So if anybody is experiencing using that, you could unmute yourself or chime in the chat.
And in the meantime, let's finish the security settings. So if you're using Rogers or Bell, there's some information to help you set things up the way that Chris thinks it should be. And with that, we actually have the last 12 minutes where we've really got no prepared material to go through. This is the end of the main deck. So if people have questions, now is the time. See, something just came in. Another question. Jocelyn says, recently NASA sent a spacecraft to deviate an asteroid named DART. And if you search Google for DART mission and check the screen for a few seconds, you'll get a little surprise. Well, that's something to play with. Google DART mission. No, I have to go and do that.
Yeah, it is kind of funny. Google, some of their people have too much time on their hands. But it's good for a chuckle.
Okay, waiting for questions.
Lorraine is raising her hand. If you unmute, yep, Elaine.
I had sent a question, but I don't see it anywhere. So I guess I'm going to ask it. And I guess it's a dumb question because you guys are all extra professionals. For the longest time, what I do before I go to bed, I put my computer on sleep. But then when I was doing research on all sort of problems that I had, I came up and to see something that says once in a while you have to shut down your computer.
Yeah.
So how should I turn off my computer every night?
Okay, Alan, have you got the slides ready? We thought we wouldn't have time for it for this week, so we were going to put it into next week. But seeing as nobody has said anything for the 10-minute question period, we can go ahead with this one. So I put together a little bit on this, and I'd really like this to be a conversation as well. This is a question as it came in by email from Lorraine. How to leave the computer at the end of the day. And she usually uses sleep. And should she use sign out or shut down instead? So next.
Sorry, it's not advancing. All right, what do I need to do?
Just click on the slide that should advance.
This will be resumed as soon as possible.
If you click on the slide itself there, it should advance.
Well, mine has, but the Zoom hasn't.
Oh, okay.
Let me just try from the beginning. It's not pulling up the presentation view for some reason. Slideshow, the current slide.
Want me to share from mine?
I think that might be a good idea. Oh, wait a minute.
Well, you can just give me a quick answer.
No, it's not a quick answer.
Oh, it's not.
Share your screen, Chris, because I can't get this thing running.
Okay, let me just do the five, and now I'm gonna lose.
Well, you can leave it.
No, that's fine. Okay, so you seeing my slide now?
Yes, that's good.
Okay. There we go. So the correct answer to all computer-related questions is, that depends. So I think what you have to really ask yourself is, what is it you're trying to accomplish? And here are some of the things that I thought, when people talk about shutting down versus leaving the computer running, these are some of the questions that they may be trying to solve, or the issues they're trying to solve. Do they want to save electricity? Do they want to save wear and tear on the computer, because if it's on all the time, presumably it's going to last a shorter period of time? Are you trying to stop hackers from getting into your computer when you're not at the computer? Or is it something else? So again, if people chime in on this, I'm really, really happy to hear, because these are, you know, my very random thoughts about these particular issues. So if you want to save electricity, so certainly a computer that is turned off uses minimal electricity. It typically will not use zero. So there will be a little bit of a trickle of power into it. A lot of that is so it can do wake on LAN and things like that. But typically it's using very, very tiny amounts of electricity even when it's turned off. So how much is actually used by an idling computer? So if you just have a computer that's sitting there basically, you know, you're not doing anything with it, there is a very high degree of variability in it. I look to see what people were saying. Desktop computers, not atypical to have it about 100 watts of power that are being used. And a laptop, because they are designed to run off the battery, they really sip electricity rather than guzzle it. And so a laptop typically might be around 25 watts. If you're in sleep mode, typically they will use about one-third of the idling electricity. So if you're in sleep mode, it allows you to get back to work very quickly. Everything is left open and running. All your documents are open and so forth. And within a second or two, you can be back at work. And so you've saved a bunch of electricity by having it in sleep mode. If you use hibernation mode, it uses almost zero electricity, or it should. I've run into some computers that for some reason, even when they go into hibernation mode, they are using a bunch of power for something. I don't know what. It will save the state of the computer. So your open programs, websites you're connected to, and things like that, it'll save that state, and then it will shut down. And then when you start it back up again, it reads that hibernation file to bring you back to that same state, logged in with the same programs open, same documents, and all the rest of it. So if you want to save electricity, yes, it definitely can save electricity to either go into sleep mode, hibernation mode, or to shut down your computer altogether. If you want to save wear and tear on your computer, well, I think most computer components should last probably beyond the useful life of the computer. At a certain point, you get where software won't run, or you get a piece of hardware that won't run with it, or you just want something that is faster or more powerful or things like that. So I think for most people, your components should last well beyond what you might consider to be the useful life of the computer. Now, I know a lot of people argue with that, and that's fine. You come up with your own assessment on that. There used to be an issue with thermal expansion and contraction due to heating up and cooling of components. And so you would have failures due to that, and you would have actually chip creep where chips were actually socketed. And as they heated up, when you turned it on and cooled down, they would actually come out of the socket a little bit, and you'd have to reseat chips. Well, we don't have typically things in sockets where they can do that anymore. And so I think the thermal expansion and contraction pretty much is not something that you have to really worry about on that. So the idea of turning a computer on and off causing an issue, probably not. Storage devices will wear out quicker when power is left on. I put a question mark because I don't know how much this is really an issue. If you have a hard disk drive, it's a mechanical device. There is a mean time between failure on that device. And I doubt that the life of a hard disk drive is really significantly impaired by leaving it running 24 hours a day. However, it is mechanical. If a mechanical device is left running, it is going to fail sooner than if you turn it off. Solid-state drive, an SSD. Computers are periodically writing even when they are sitting there idle. And each storage cell can only be written to a certain number of times on an SSD. Again, I doubt that the life of an SSD is significantly impaired by leaving it running 24 hours a day. The early SSDs, I think this was an issue. I think SSDs nowadays, probably not really an issue. So wear and tear, probably overall, I would assess it as being not really a big deal. Preventing your computer from being hacked. So a computer that is turned off can't be hacked. That's true. But if you think about it, you need protections for when you are at the computer and using it and you're connected to the internet. So those same protections will protect your computer even when you're not using it. So I don't particularly look at it as being an issue where I want to turn off my computer when I'm not sitting in front of it in order to prevent it from being hacked. If I'm concerned about it being hacked, I need to be concerned about it when I'm using the computer. So that's it for the my thoughts on it. I would be happy to, and I see some comments on in the chat, so I think that's good. Okay, so Tom says hibernation uses up SSD life. That's true, because again, I think it's probably not that huge an issue, but it will write the current state to a file on your computer. And that current state file, the hibernation file, will be the size of your in-use RAM. So it could be, 16 gigabyte or more file that it writes to. So it's going to write that data to the hard drive or to the SSD, and then so it can read from it when it comes alive the next time. Again, I really wonder how much that's going to really affect the life of an SSD to write 16 gigs to it once a day or something like that. But yes, anything use on any kind of storage device presumably is going to shorten its life somehow.
Well, to some extent, Chris, that depends how big the SSD is.
That's true, yeah. Yeah, I mean, SSDs also have wear leveling, where they will try to move stuff around on the disk so that it's not always writing to exactly the same locations. So there's a lot of technology that's built into SSDs nowadays that prolong the life of the devices for sure.
It also depends on how big your RAM is. If you have 64 gigabytes like I do, a lot of that is going to go into a hibernation file if I use one.
Yeah, it'll only be the amount that's in use, but certainly, yes, if you're using a lot of your RAM, and Windows will use a lot of RAM for caching and things like that, and that'll end up in the hibernation file for sure. So it definitely can be an issue. So if people are using an SSD as their main C drive, you might want to consider not using hibernation.
Yeah, but I doubt if any of the caching is actually hibernated. I think that probably is not. But
okay, could be.
But when I look at my usage of memory, it's usually less than 64 gig. It's usually less than 32, in fact. So maybe I wasted some money.
Yeah. Alan asks the question, what does everybody think is the best thing to do with the computer overnight or if you're going to be out of the house for several hours? Personally, on my computers, they stay turned on. I've gone back and forth between putting it just to sleep, as opposed to not sleeping at all, just letting it run. I've had some issues with my backup software, which is supposed to be able to wake up the computer out of sleep mode to run the backup at 2 o'clock in the morning. I find that it only works about a third of the time that way, so sometimes I've turned it off so I don't even go to sleep mode so that the backups run reliably. Otherwise, I just run the backup manually in the morning when I start using my computer, which is not a huge issue. If I'm going on vacation, I'll shut down my computers and the router. If anybody else wants to weigh in, Tom says he sleeps when he's away for under an hour. shut down when longer. He says capacitors, condensers age on and off, on or off. When they leak and fail, you got a problem. Tristan says nothing wrong with using sleep, although with Windows, it's generally a good idea to reboot or full shutdown once every week or two. Yeah, Windows has a tendency to, every now and then, you know, something is getting haywire inside it, and a reboot is not necessarily a bad thing to do for sure. And Tristan says it all became a bit pointless if I have a new NVMe SSD. A startup from full shutdown is almost as fast as resume from sleep. Yeah, and then certainly resume from hibernation as well. Full startup is usually as fast as coming back from hibernation, just having it have to read the hibernation file. Eodriscoll says, I shut down overnight usually. I often have many things open, too many things. Yeah, it's getting those documents and programs back running that I find to be the tedious part of doing a shutdown.
I kind of agree with Tristan. I actually have an SSD. It's an old SSD, so it's not one of these super fast ones, but it's really quick from a full shutdown to boot up. So I don't bother with sleep and hibernation typically.
Yeah. Stu points out that what we've been talking about is generalities. And so, Lorraine, does this actually help you at all in assessing whether you should do a shutdown or not?
We need to.
I mean, I can do anything. I mean, your guys are the experts, you know. I mean, I've been doing the same thing for a long, long time at work. When I was working, we were told absolutely do not shut down your computer at night. Do a log off. So yeah. When I got here, I said log off. That means sleep. So I said well, sleep. I guess. And then when I was doing something else, trying to do something else, I came across this information. That were saying once in a while you have to turn off your computer totally, but it's okay. I guess it's okay to leave it asleep, but there's also something that says sign out. So, like, what's the difference between sign out and shut down now? You know, so
well,
one thing leads to the other. So,
yeah, sign out would log you out of your account, and so, it would leave Windows running so you can get back to work faster than if you do a shutdown because you just have to do a login. So it prevents somebody from coming along and who has access to your computer and discovering that you left yourself logged in and they can access all your information, that sort of idea. Now, you can also just lock the computer. You know, Windows and the L key will lock the computer. So, you know, you can actually do that. To prevent anybody in your household from being able to access it. The reason why your work would have told you don't shut down, just do a logout, is because they want to be able to do remote management on the computer so they can do updates and things like that. They can't do that if the computer's been shut down. So that's why they want you to leave it, you know, just logged out. The computer's running, then they can remotely manage the computer. That, when you're in a home environment, is not going to be an issue. For doing that. So I think a lot of it comes down to convenience.
Okay, but another question, another thing that that comes to mind is the computer is supposed to send me updates every so often, you know, and I think, and I've seen lots of times this update won't take effect until you shut down your computer and restart.
Yeah.
So then that takes me, like if I put it on sleep, it's like I'm getting my updates all the time. But then, if I never restart my computer ever,
they won't get applied.
I don't get my updates?
It means that the updates won't be applied. So the updates themselves will get trickled down to your computer while you're using it, and then you will get the notice, a pop-up that says, you know, you have to restart your computer to update your computer, and that's when the updates will actually get applied. So almost certainly every Patch Tuesday, second Tuesday of the month, when Microsoft pushes out the patches, either that day or within a couple of days of that, you're going to need to reboot in order for those patches to actually apply. And you can also tell that those are in effect. They would be in the notification area that it'll tell you that, you know, in order to apply the updates, you have to restart. Also, if you click on the start button and you go to do a shutdown, you'll see the option, you know, shut down and do updates or reboot and do updates. You know, it'll say in there that the update is actually going to be applied at that point in time. So yes, at certain points, you do have to do at least a restart. Or a shutdown, and they'll get applied the next time you start up your computer. I always recommend that people don't do the option of saying update and shutdown, because in actual fact, it only does half of the update process when you do that, and that means that when you start up your computer the next time, it's going to finish the actual updates. If you happen to get one of those updates that happens to take half an hour, then you're going to be sitting waiting when you turn on your computer for about a half an hour while the updates are actually getting finished on your computer. So I always recommend people do it as an update and restart. And then if you want, just walk away or whatever. But then if it takes half an hour, or if it even took an hour, then that's fine. The next time you come to use your computer, the updates will have been completely applied on the computer and you can go ahead and start using it at that point.
Tristan notes that if an update's pending reboot, Windows will force the reboot after a certain amount of time.
Yeah, you can override that.
And generally, the auto reboot will happen late at night, even if the computer is left in sleep mode.
Yeah, which I find very ignorant of Microsoft to do that.
So a couple of things. We're over the hour here. Ed says if left on 24/7, any corruption that develops can persist perhaps for a long time. Bridget says, put it to sleep to stop the fan from failing prematurely, also from sucking in dust. She had a fan fail because of that. Okay, that was a great question, Lorraine. We thought that
and
was
I,
very
And good. I thought it was a dumb question.
No, not at all.
Everybody has their own ideas of what's right and wrong, especially on that issue. Anyway, I'm going to wrap up here. Okay, so you've had your chance to ask all those kinds of questions. We have meeting topics set for November and December, but there's nothing scheduled for our main monthly meetings from January on. So Lawrence is looking for suggestions for topics. So if you have any bright ideas, topics you'd like to hear about, speakers who you know about that you could suggest we could approach, and just send us an email and we'll pass it along to Lawrence. And we are over time, we're almost 10 minutes over. And so I just remind you that next week we have our next Q&A session. If you have questions or topics that you want to share, send a message to suggestion box and we'll sign you up. So thanks for attending tonight. Hope everybody enjoyed the session, and we'll talk to you later. Bye for now.
Thanks, folks. Good night.